A relational database often holds critical operational data for a company, including usernames and financial information. Since this data is so important, a relational database must be architected to avoid data loss. Relational databases need to be a distributed system in order to provide the fault tolerance necessary for production use cases. If a database node goes down, the database must be able to recover smoothly without data loss. And this requires having all of the data in the database replicated beyond a single node. If you write to a distributed transactional database, that write must be propagated to each of the other nodes in the database. If you read from a distributed database, that read must return the same data that any other database reader would see. And these constraints can be satisfied differently depending on the design of the database system. As a result, there's a vast market of distributed databases out there, from cloud providers to software vendors. CockroachDB is an open-source, globally consistent relational database. CockroachDB is heavily informed by Google Spanner, which is the relational database that Google uses for much of its transactional workloads. Peter Mattis is a co-founder of CockroachDB, and he joins the show to discuss the architecture of CockroachDB, the process of building a business around a database, and his memories working on distributed systems at Google. Full disclosure, CockroachDB is a sponsor of Software Engineering Daily. Peter, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
You were at Google for almost a decade, and some of that time was spent working on the file system, Colossus. Today, you work on CockroachDB. How does building a file system compare to building a database?
It's a lot easier for two reasons. I mean, the surface area of a file system is much smaller than the surface area of a database. The thing that was a huge challenge with Colossus is everything inside Google is about enormous scale. So you think externally like, oh, I'm going to have a cluster of machines, maybe 100 machines or 1,000. And Google's like, tens of thousands of machines. That's what we need to schedule to. And now it's like hundreds of thousands of machines. So your systems are running at enormous scale. And scale was just like the thing to be concerned about all the time. But the kind of the surface area, what I'm referring to as the surface area, is just the number of API calls and the API entry points and the number of operations that a file system performs is much more limited than a database, and especially much more limited than a SQL database. A SQL database, like CockroachDB, has a gigantic surface area. So you're thinking a file system. You open files, you read some bytes, you write some bytes. You have to worry about, you know, for Colossus, we had to worry about replication and availability and redundancy. We still have all that replication, availability, redundancy problems inside CockroachDB, but then we have to deal with all the semantics of SQL. We have to deal with SQL execution, a SQL optimizer. We have more stringent backup restore requirements importing from other systems. It's just the complexity of CockroachDB is much, much higher than it is for Colossus.
When you were at Google, you worked with Spanner and Bigtable. Tell me about the use case for those respective data stores.
Yeah, so the original use case for Bigtable was used in the indexing pipeline at Google. And for the indexing pipeline, it wasn't really a transactional system per se. They're kind of doing these bulk loads and operations and then performing the manipulations as part of the indexing pipeline process. And yet, very quickly, other developers inside Google saw this as being like, hey, can we use this for other purposes? And they started kind of extending and asking for additional functionality that made it more appropriate to use for end user applications. The indexing pipeline isn't really an end user application. It's a batch process that takes place inside Google. We started seeing use cases where people are using Bigtable, trying to, you know, considering like, oh, can I put Gmail on top of Bigtable? So, you know, it should also be known that I worked on Gmail early on. I was one of the early developers working on Gmail. So I was very familiar with that backend, and it was not built on top of Bigtable. Bigtable came about after the initial Gmail architecture was built. But as soon as Bigtable came about, people were like, I want to start using this. Seems like a great way to do things. It scales horizontally. It gives me kind of the API stuff I need to build an application on top of. And yet they very quickly started running into the friction points too. And the friction points are, it doesn't have transactions. It has these kind of semantics that were not quite exactly what applications wanted. And that's where the initial Bigtable authors went back to the drawing board and said like, we really, really need to do something that's more like a traditional database. And Spanner emerged from there. So Spanner, they really were like, okay, let's sit down and think about how we really want to build this thing for the types of applications that people are struggling to use Bigtable for. And there was actually an intermediary system here called Megastore. So Megastore was kind of tacked on top of Bigtable, and it added some of that transactionality and indexing functionality that you, an application might want on top of Bigtable. And yet it was kind of glommed on. It wasn't kind of integrated. So you can almost see Spanner as, you know, reimagining of what incorporating Megastore into Bigtable from the get-go would look like. It's quite a bit more than that, but that is like, you know, one way you can view it. But it's a complete rewrite of those systems. And very quickly, you know, like the ads database at the time was running into scale problems, and the ads people were like, hey, we won't need to replace it with something else. Can we actually use Spanner for this purpose? Now, originally Spanner didn't have a SQL interface to it, and the ads folks needed the SQL interface. There's no way they're going to convert their existing system to something that didn't have a SQL interface. So they went ahead and implemented this system called F1 that sat on top of Spanner. Eventually, you know, this got enough usage that Spanner and F1 people who were working very closely together just merged the two together. I'm not actually sure now. I've been gone from Google for a number of years. I'm not sure if F1 actually exists separately from Spanner now. I know Spanner has SQL functionality just built into it.
You mentioned that with Bigtable, there was an inability to have transactions. What does that mean? I think of a transaction as fundamental to a data storage system.
Yeah, well, you know, file systems are data storage systems, and, you know, they kind of have transactions in a funny way. They're very limited, but it's not what you can traditionally call a transaction. Like, I think when I use the term transaction, that you can have an arbitrary set of operations. There's some amount of isolation between concurrent transactions so that either, you know, transactions will get aborted if there's conflicts, or there will be some kind of a locking mechanism present inside of it. So, you know, the transactions you get from a file system don't really have that. You have some amount of atomicity you get from certain operations like rename, but you don't get like real kind of, you know, full-fledged transactions. Bigtable did not have kind of full-fledged transactions. There was no notion of locking. You know, the application itself would have to be structured in such a way that it wouldn't create conflicting operations. Or if it did have conflicting operations, that it would be able to recover from those. And one of the ways you would do that is there's often natural sharding that takes place inside an application. And to give you a concrete example of that is an application like Gmail. So the natural sharding in Gmail is on a user basis. And, you know, if you were to implement Gmail on top of a Bigtable, one thing you could do is just kind of say like, oh, here is my front end server that's talking to Bigtable, and I'm going to kind of have some external locking mechanism that ensures that only one of my front end servers can actually be manipulating a user's data at a time. That kind of locks out all that data, even though it's external from Bigtable itself.
So this was back in the early 2000s, and you're talking about data infrastructure inside of Google. Now, outside of Google, there were plenty of people who had large database deployments, but did not have the Google infrastructure. And I've done some interviews with companies in that vintage. And a common problem that I hear in the scalability issues was that they would have to handle the scalability with client sharding. Like the client would have to talk to individual database shards. And so the internal database infrastructure wouldn't take care of the scalability. You actually had to defer some of the shard management or the shard communications to the people who are just like accessing the database as like, you know, internal service developers. Is that consistent with your understanding of what was going on outside of Google, the problems that people were encountering managing database infrastructure?
Certainly. And it was actually taking place inside Google as well. So one of the systems inside Google that used databases heavily, traditional SQL databases, was the ad serving system. And this was built on top of MySQL. And they actually had sharded MySQL, and they actually changed the number of shards over time, this resharding operation. And that resharding operation inside Google, outside Google, wherever it happens, is usually incredibly painful. And this was one of the motivations for that ad system to actually eventually migrate onto Spanner, is they were just getting tired of handling the, you know, I think they went from tens of shards of MySQL to hundreds to eventually thousands, and they changed things, went back to hundreds, and it was about up to thousands again. But just kind of a nightmare of complexity of dealing with that kind of sharding at the application layer. I mean, really, this is one of the kind of the core tenets of CockroachDB, is we feel that if you're having to do this sharding work external to the database, you're essentially pulling some of the database functionality into your application. And, you know, taking that burden on of implementing a database inside your application. And oftentimes you're giving up things, you know, very frequently you don't have cross-shard transactions. So your transactions have to be limited to a single shard. You're not dealing with the easy scalability the same way that a database itself might deal with it internally. And this is just too much of a burden for application developers.
So you co-founded Cockroach Labs in 2015, and this is long after you were working at Google. And so this is like as late as 2015, people are still having issues with this application level sharding, with these just relational database management problems. As late as 2015, why wasn't this problem solved?
I mean, that's a good question. Why wasn't this problem solved? I'm not sure why it wasn't solved. Certainly, one of the reasons we actually founded Cockroach Labs is, you know, after Google, my co-founders and I, we went off to another startup. Then we eventually wound up at Square. And at Square, we saw some of this exact same pain points. They had a monolithic MySQL database. They were trying to figure out how to pull bits of it to keep it scaling further. They're having to buy increasingly large hardware to run this database on. And they're eventually looking into how to shard it. And we're like, why is this still happening? That was 2014. Why is this still happening in 2014? And we took a look around and, you know, there's essentially, you know, people who are looking at NoSQL systems being like, I've got this horizontal scalability, but it doesn't have the functionality applications most applications want. It doesn't have, they don't have transactions, they don't have indexing, all the niceties you would get from a traditional SQL database. And the other end of the spectrum, you have the SQL databases, and the SQL databases are like, we'll give you all this functionality, but you know, sorry, you're going to have to do sharding eventually when you get to a certain scale. And you know, like, why wasn't there some marriage in the middle? You know, I'm not quite sure. It feels like, you know, Spanner was leading the way in what we should do. And, you know, like we came around at the right time identifying the fact that, you know, this is now possible. Spanner is like a proof point that this is possible, where previously people said, no, if you want to have the scalability, you have to give up all this functionality. And the answer is really, no, you don't. I think some things did actually change technology-wise. Networks are super fast now. I mean, historically, when SQL databases were being developed, computer networks were very slow. And now, you know, communication between two machines within a data center is faster than accessing your local disk. So computer networks are very fast. They continue to get faster. Another advancement is advances in replication protocols. You know, Paxos has been around for whatever it is, 20, 25 years now, notoriously hard to implement, but we've increased our understanding dramatically over that time. Raft is a similar consensus protocol, but even since 2015, the advancement in the academic understanding of consensus protocols has, it feels like there's just been this Cambrian explosion of understanding of these protocols, and really understanding that Paxos, Raft, and all these other ones that academics have come up with are just different points on this spectrum of replication protocols.
So with all those incremental advancements, improvements in networking, improvements in consensus, I mean, CockroachDB is commonly referred to as an open source version of Spanner, but there is so much in the way of different design decisions you could make. If we talk about, again, these incremental improvements to infrastructure, how much has the design of CockroachDB diverged from what you originally built when you were looking at the Spanner paper as something of a reference implementation?
Yeah, well, the most obvious way it diverged is when we first got started 5 years ago, SQL was not on our roadmap. We were looking at, you know, trying to adapt and understand what the Spanner API was, which they don't really go into it in depth in the Spanner paper, but looking at some kind of key value API. We were taking a look at Cassandra and some of the other systems out there, the NoSQL systems, and seeing if we could adapt it and then introduce transactions and, you know, more full-fledged indexes. So the big divergence is at some point along the line, we were like, actually, what we should do is embrace SQL. And I think that was a fantastic decision in hindsight. Didn't realize how monumental it would be when we made that decision. But above and beyond that, you know, like the description in the Spanner paper is high level. And when you actually get down to the nitty gritty of like the bits and pieces, I think there's like still a lot of similarities with Spanner, but saying that we're an open source Spanner, I would say maybe more we're inspired by, you know, the Spanner design. And they certainly, you know, blazed a path that we walked in for a while, but now we've gone off on our own path.
Why is it? So that original Spanner paper, they had their own API. Why did that database have its own API? Why didn't they implement it with SQL from the outset? Is there something about having a fully SQL compliant interface that's difficult to build?
Yeah, it's a huge monumental task. Now you can look and see if there's components you can pull off the shelf. You know, can you repurpose aspects of like the PostgreSQL implementation or perhaps the MySQL implementation? But all those things are kind of tightly wed together. There's not like you can't just cookie cutter take the SQL execution engine from Postgres and slap it onto something else and really hit the scalability point that we're after with CockroachDB or that, you know, the Spanner designers were after with Spanner. I think another aspect of that within Spanner is, you know, the people designing Spanner were the people who designed and implemented Bigtable. And Bigtable had its own API, and that API was kind of informing some of their decisions for Spanner as well.
So you co-founded Cockroach Labs in 2015, and you launched the database company with an open source repository. How long did it take you and the team to get the database ready for a release into the open?
Oh, my memory of this is vague. I mean, I think it was it 2 years it took to get to our 1.0 release? I'd have to go look that up. Time flies, so to speak. It's hard for me to even recall that it's been 5 years and how far we've come in that time period. It took a little bit longer than we imagined. We already had some of the pieces in place. And, you know, I think part of starting any company is you have to forget how much work is going to be involved and almost consciously be ignorant of the amount of work that's going to be involved. So we were a little bit optimistic in how quickly you're going to be able to get out that first version. It took longer than we expected. Part of this was because our aspirations grew. Our first version had SQL. And when we started the company, we didn't actually know SQL was going to be in there. So I think we made that decision 6 to 9 months after the company founded. And then I think the 1.0 release was maybe 2 years after we came out. I'd have to look that up.
Do you recall what was the hardest part of that first implementation? I mean, you're saying you underestimated the difficulty of the undertaking. Was there some particular implementation detail that you recall as being, you know, really hard to finish?
There was no one particular implementation detail, but I'll tell you a little story about our kind of stability woes at some point in time. So as you're developing any new piece of software, you know, especially a complex piece of software, there's a period of time where it's not working at all, and then it kind of flips over and it starts to work. But when it, you know, it's not like a bright line where it goes from not functional at all to functional. It kind of, you know, transitions. And that transition is, you know, it's like, oh, hey, we can run it for a period of time. Oh, it crashed. Oh, okay, we fixed a bug. Let's run some additional queries against it. Oh, it crashed. And, you know, we're doing normal development. We're doing, you know, unit tests and integration tests. But it was just trying to get clusters of Cockroach stable for longer periods of time that took quite a bit longer than, you know, I think any of us expected. We went through this period, we call it the stability code yellow. And code yellow is a term that we borrowed from our Google days, where a code yellow is just some kind of problem that is a company impacting problem. If we don't get past this, the company is going to die. So it was all hands on deck for the stability code yellow. It lasted for a couple months, and we kind of dropped all the functionality feature work we were working on and just focused on, you know, addressing stability woes. And, you know, at the time there was like, you know, kind of a dark period where like, are we ever going to get beyond this? And it went from the database running for minutes at a time to hours at a time to days at a time to weeks at a time. And, you know, now we're at the point, you know, like years later, that understanding the database running for years at a time is no question. But just in the moment there, it feels pretty dark. You're like, ah, how are we ever going to get this thing just stable and get through all these bugs and whatnot? You do it. I've seen this happen several times. When you're in the midst of it, it never feels great. And then you get to the other side and you're like, ah, okay, I see what had to be done. In hindsight, there might have been some additional work we could have been doing up front on the integration and stability testing. Maybe, not quite sure. I just feel that some, like, you know, any big effort like this has to go that through a period of the dark times. I remember similar things happening on Gmail shortly before we launched the original version of Gmail. Some dark days there as well.
You were working on the database with your co-founders. What was the division of labor? Did you have a stark division of labor, or did you all just pile in and get an understanding of the entire infrastructure of the database?
We had a division of labor. It wasn't stark. It was more we kind of divvied up big areas between us. For example, very early on, my co-founder, Ben Darnell, he worked on Raft and all the pieces around Raft. I kind of jumped in into a variety of places, though I ended up getting like the initial work on the SQL execution and original SQL heuristic planner going. Spencer, he had actually kind of put all the groundwork. He laid the base foundation originally and then started doing work on the distributed transaction protocol. But I wouldn't say the divisions were ever stark. So we all jumped in into the various areas where necessary. There was also a division in labor in terms of kind of the responsibilities of the founder. Spencer Kimball, he's our CEO. He's the one who paints the vision, goes out and, you know, works with the investors. He's much more outward focused. I act as the CTO, much more heavily involved in technology, and Ben acts as the chief architect. He's like the kind of the final arbiter of design decisions, especially contentious ones.
Let's talk about the engineering and the actual architecture of CockroachDB. The underlying data is stored in sorted key value pairs. How does this data layout of being arranged in key value pairs, how does that compare to how data is laid out on disk in a relational database like MySQL?
It's relatively similar. So underneath the hood in a traditional OLTP-based relational database, you're going to have some kind of something similar to key value storage. It might not be called key value storage, but if you squint at InnoDB, which is the backend for MySQL, at least it's the default backend for MySQL, it's a B-tree storage, and B-trees are storing keys and values. They might be not storing actual string keys and string values the way we are in CockroachDB. It might actually, there might be delimiters inside those, and I actually don't know the details of what InnoDB does, but at some level, it's kind of still keys and values. You have keys that are part of the lookup. Those might be, you know, delimited, as I said, and then you have values, and the values might also be delimited. Inside CockroachDB, at some layer, there are keys and values where the kind of the contents in the keys and values are opaque, but the higher level, it's SQL. SQL is arranged to format those keys and values so that you have that kind of column structure inside the keys and the values. So that's very similar. There's also OLAP databases. When you talk about the relational database landscape, an analytics database and OLAP database, those are frequently column stores. And the difference between kind of a transactional processing database and one of these analytic databases in how they store data on disk is the column stores arranged to store all the values for a particular column kind of adjacent on disk. And then they can load it up, all that column data in one easy read and process it in a more efficient manner. The benefit to this is it makes your read queries much, much faster, but it slows down your update queries.
And what is the translation process for a query? See, there's these five layers in CockroachDB that defines how a SQL query is eventually translated into a key value query. So you have the SQL layer, the transactional layer, the distribution layer, the replication, and finally the storage layer. Why do you need these five layers for managing a query?
Well, this is part about like how much effort it is to go through and the expertise you need at each level. So, you know, down at the lowest level, how we're storing things on disk, we have this MVCC multi-version concurrency control layer built on top of RocksDB. And there's just deep expertise you have to know about interacting with, you know, the disk storage on disk and the management there. So the layers are kind of like oriented in terms of, you know, knowledge and expertise areas. Above the MVCC, that's where you have replication. What are all the complexities in dealing with Raft and making a high performance replication protocol? Above that, you have distributed transactions. Distributed transactions are not simple, and it's layered on top of the replication just so that we can actually have a group of engineers who have that expertise and competence there. And then above the distributed transactions, you have SQL. And SQL itself is broken into a SQL optimizer, which takes care of the planning of the query, and SQL execution, which takes the plan that the optimizer spit out and then executes that plan to completion. And it's just, you know, again, different areas of expertise. The people working on optimizer, they have to be very knowledgeable about the relational algebra and the validity of various transforms and how to apply, you know, table statistics into a cost model to decide which query plan to execute. The execution folks, they have to be experts at having and optimizing the execution of a particular query plan. Each query plan is composed of these various operators, and, you know, the internal details of those operators are complex. So I think like the kind of layering you see is some aspect of managing the complexity, keeping the complexity from pervading everywhere and having it scoped down to a size that a single team can manage. You know, something to be aware of, though, here is sometimes these layers don't, you know, they can get in the way. You know, we're seeing academic research come out right now that's saying, hey, you know, having distributed transactions built on top of a replication layer, that there's kind of a duplication of effort there. And, you know, look at what we can do if we actually blend these two layers together and have them be aware of each other. So this is something that we're paying attention to. It's something we've thought about. Like sometimes the layers are just getting in the way and you might want to get rid of them.
What are the places where the developer might want to configure something and change something in one of these layers? Would that ever happen? Or is like the actual database user, would they want to tweak something that would affect specifically the transactional layer? Or are these layers really only in the purview of the people who are actually building CockroachDB? They're not database operator areas of modification.
They're really, for the most part, in the purview of the Cockroach Labs developers, CockroachDB developers. There are knobs in some of these areas, and to give you an example of that, down at the low level, you know, there's a cache in RocksDB, a block cache, and the size of that block cache affects, you know, the performance of read queries, and that's a knob that's available for external tuning. There's also knobs for controlling certain things in the optimizer. Those are almost never tuned, but they exist. There's a few other knobs in the system, but for the most part, you know, kind of having a preponderance of knobs, I think, gets in the way of the usability of a system, and we've tried to have most things just do the right thing and automatically tune themselves. I can't say we've achieved that goal perfectly, but that's certainly the goal.
You've mentioned RocksDB a couple times, and RocksDB is an underlying storage engine that powers various database systems. Explain what the purpose of a storage engine is.
So the purpose of RocksDB, at some level, a database has to write stuff down onto disk. And, you know, kind of naively, you might think, oh, I'll just open a file and write some data to the file, but then I have to read that data back. And that means structuring the data that I wrote into the file in a certain way that makes it easy to find it. Now, there are systems, you know, there's been research in this area for as long as there have been relational databases for even longer. One of the ways to structure things on disk is as a B-tree. This is a balanced tree structure. RocksDB is slightly different, uses something called a log structured merge tree, but it's conceptually like the, you know, if you step back and squint, a log structured merge tree and a B tree both kind of provide the same primitive, which is I can write keys and values into this structure, and then I can get them back in order, in sorted order. And taking care like the details of how that happens, it is complex. You know, for B-tree, you have these rebalancing mechanisms. For RocksDB, you have a series of SS tables and levels and compaction heuristics. But the fundamental need there is I need to have some way that I can, you know, write these keys and values and have them be persistently stored on disk and then read them back later in a desired order.
So all of the underlying data is divided into ranges, and these ranges are each replicated. And for each of the replica sets, there's one replica that's called a leaseholder, and that's the replica that handles the read and write requests. So if you have all of the data that's, you know, it's replicated at least three times, you've got at least three servers, you know, in the default case that contain one of the instances of the data, why not have each of those replicas serve requests? Why do you need to designate one specific replica as the replica that's going to be actually performing or handling the read and write requests?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. It would be desirable to be able to read from any replica. It's desirable for several reasons. You get kind of better aggregate resource usage in your cluster. Maybe one of those replicas is nearby you, so you avoid geographic latency in doing the read. The problem with being able to read from every replica is how to do that consistently. So if I was allowing you to read from any replica and write came in somewhere else, that there's this whole coordination that has to take place there. And when, you know, like the various ways to do that coordination, you know, there's not that many. And one of them is to actually kind of funnel all the requests through this central choke point, which is this leaseholder replica for the range. But it's always fundamentally about providing consistency, consistent answer. You wouldn't want to have it the case that, you know, two reads to the same bit of data hit two different replicas and they get a different answer just because one replica is slightly behind. That would be a big no-no for our whole consistency story. It'd be very surprising to the application developer.
I'd like to understand the interface between CockroachDB and RocksDB, the storage engine, in a little more detail. Can you tell me where does the abstraction boundary between CockroachDB and RocksDB lie? Like, what's the interface between those two?
Yeah, so the interface is essentially RocksDB exposes relatively small set of primitives. You have operations for setting the keys, deleting a range of keys. You can actually ingest a whole set of keys as well. There's this ingestion operation. What is exposed up to CockroachDB? There's this MVCC layer that I mentioned before, multi-version concurrency control, that sits on top of RocksDB. And that essentially kind of tweaks those primitives that RocksDB provides and then, you know, kind of exposes them up to the next layer up, which is this kind of per node storage system. And so what it looks like is you're able to, within the Cockroach node, just this one component knows about talking to RocksDB, and it has operations such as put a row, you know, retrieve a row, scan a whole bunch of rows, and those get translated fairly directly into API calls on RocksDB. So kind of the, you know, the surface area there, it's relatively locked into, you know, kind of one fraction of the code, maybe, you know, 10% of the CockroachDB code base knows about that. But there have been some RocksDB-isms that have escaped beyond those boundaries. Kind of the primary one is RocksDB has this file format on disk. It's called SS tables, sorted string tables. And this is, you know, it's not like a formally defined format, but it's not a format that's going to change. We actually end up leveraging that format as our backup format that is used for storing backups up into, you know, cloud storage like S3 or Google Storage. Another instance where RocksDBisms have escaped past this API boundary is something that's a little bit more, you know, kind of down in the weeds. RocksDB, in addition to having operations for setting value, you can actually have this thing that's called a batch. And a batch provides a container for a group of operations that RocksDB guarantees will all be applied atomically. So when you write a batch, you're guaranteed like all the operations in the batch, they either occur atomically or they didn't occur at all. And inside the batch, there's a representation of the format of these operations. And that kind of internal batch representation has leaked out of some of our abstractions. I don't feel too bad about either of these leakages just because these formats are so, you know, well specified and understood that we could eventually, you know, get rid of RocksDB and replace it with something else and there wouldn't be a problem. And I should mention that that's actually something that's coming down the path. We are looking to replace RocksDB with another system that's going to be compatible with these data storage formats.
Interesting. Wait, did you say you're planning to replace RocksDB entirely?
Yeah, that's the intention.
And so what's the motivation for doing that?
The motivation for doing that is many traditional SQL databases, they actually, you know, have their own storage engine inside. You know, MySQL tightly wed to NODB. And while there's a RocksDB backend for MySQL, it comes with a lot of caveats. And you know, not all of the MySQL functionality is available if you use that RocksDB backend. Cassandra comes with its own LSM tree internally. They're looking at this other, you know, RocksDB backend, but again, it comes with caveats. Now, the thing about using RocksDB is it's absolutely the right decision when CockroachDB got started. We wouldn't want to have to, you know, reinvent the entire world. But over time, there's customizations we want to make. And, you know, we have to own that storage layer. Now, there's kind of two obvious paths forward that we could, you know, kind of fork RocksDB and use it. RocksDB has a ton of functionality that we do not need. And we could fork it, strip out all that functionality, continue to own it. But there's this other thing that gets in the way here, which is RocksDB is entirely written in C++. All the rest of CockroachDB is written in Go. And we really see this barrier between the two languages. Probably, you know, you might have heard of CGo. If you're familiar with Go, you've heard of this interface called CGo, where Go can really easily call into C. And yet, despite how easy it isn't as easy as just accessing a native Go library directly. And we can't reuse functionality that's been part of the rest of CockroachDB inside and or closer to the code that interfaces with RocksDB. We also see a tons of opportunities to evolve the storage layer in service of CockroachDB. And to give you one example of that, some of our restore and import mechanisms, they're bottlenecked right now on the performance of RocksDB. And, you know, again, this is something we could look at to fix inside RocksDB. And yet the overhead of doing that versus doing it in a storage engine that we own, doing it in a storage engine we own looks to be significantly less.
So this problem of making a globally consistent database. This has obviously been noticed by other people in the industry, cloud providers, other vendors. Tell me about the design decisions that CockroachDB has made that contrast with the other attempts, the other companies that are building globally consistent SQL infrastructure.
Yeah. So there's some other startups in this space. Some of them, you know, born out of academic research. The one that comes to mind there is FaunaDB. It's born out of a research project called Calvin. So one of the decisions that, like, that the Calvin research was showing, here's how you do distributed global distributed transactions. The caveat they have is, oh, you need to specify all the operations in your transaction up front. And, you know, there's, I've heard claims from the FaunaDB folks that they know how to do interactive SQL transactions. And let me make sure I'm clear of what I mean by interactive transactions. Interactive transaction or conversational transaction is one where the application starts with a transaction, does some operations, gets the results, applies application logic that's present inside the, you know, application itself, does some other operations, you know, can do this multiple times, and then commits the transaction. So this is a very common pattern inside applications itself. FaunaDB, or at least Calvin, was saying like, hey, if you could actually specify everything about the transaction up front, we can do some really neat techniques inside the database in order to optimize it. And yet it comes with this big caveat and a significant change in how applications have to be architected. And we feel that that change is a big burden and going to be a big headwind against their adoption. There's a company out of China, PingCap, which develops a database called TIDB, has shares a lot of similarities with the CockroachDB architecture, but they have some differences. Some of their stuff is more centralized. They're not as focused on geographic replication as we are. And then we have, like, you know, some of the big players. I mean, clearly Spanner, you know, we share a lot of the architectural decisions with Spanner. Google doesn't seem to be pushing it as hard as I would have expected. I think they could be pushing it harder. Amazon and Aurora, you know, Aurora's offering, you know, kind of some geographic distribution now, but currently, you know, their current architecture involves a single master. I don't know. I know they've been talking about having multi-master Aurora for a while. I don't know if that's been, I can't recall if that's been released yet. But I mean, there's quite a big difference between having a single master node that has to coordinate stuff and becomes a bottleneck versus allowing any node to, and having the cluster scale out to enormous numbers of nodes.
And in the competitive landscape, you know, operating a business as well as building a complex distributed database, one thing I wonder is, how do you convey the subtle engineering differences to the end user? Like, is the end user, is the developer market discriminating enough to be able to see the differences between those different database architectures, or does it come down to kind of marketing?
I think there's a lot of marketing involved. Certainly, there is a subset of the developer community that is discriminating and can't understand these differences. You know, are these the early adopters or is it larger than that? Not quite sure. There's certainly a lot of marketing. I mean, SQL databases, when they first come out, you know, came out into existence 30 or 40 years ago, must have been incredibly confusing and complex. And yet over time, we figure out the right way to explain these differences and explain them in a way that makes sense. I think we're still working on this. It's a work in progress, and it's something that needs to be focused on. You figure out how to translate the, you know, kind of expert terminology into analogies that make sense for everybody. We're still working on that. We'll probably be working on that for the lifetime of the company, frankly.
Have you changed the implementation of CockroachDB significantly since Kubernetes came out?
So the answer is yes, but not because of Kubernetes. So the internal implementation of CockroachDB is constantly seeing enhancements. To give you one concrete example of that, our distributed transaction protocol has evolved significantly since the first implementation. The version of the distributed transaction protocol in version 1.0 versus what's currently in the product today, they're significantly different. And the current version is significantly better, significantly faster, lower latency, gets better parallelism. But all that came about not due to Kubernetes. So Kubernetes is clearly this tidal wave that's taking over the industry. And it just happened to coincide with the way CockroachDB nicely just meshes with the Kubernetes architecture. And we've done some minor adjustments to fit in more cleanly. We're continuing to do some adjustments. We're looking right now, we're building out a specific CockroachDB operator to make the Kubernetes Cockroach experience even better. But there haven't been huge architectural changes necessary. And I think that was more luck than anything else.
So in addition to architecting CockroachDB, you have to stand it up on the cloud providers, or you have to figure out a repeatable architecture pattern when a developer stands up a CockroachDB instance on AWS, for example. What happens when they deploy it? I'd like to know more about what happens in the design and the deployment of a cloud product. And you have to make this compliant for both AWS and GCP. So I don't know if you build it with entirely kind of open source pieces or does deploying on AWS use the AWS load balancing infrastructure and deploying it on GCP uses GCP load balancing infrastructure? What's the process of getting this thing stood up on a cloud provider?
Yeah. So, there's a choice here. And, the first division is this a customer standing it up on AWS or GCP? They have all this flexibility in what they can decide to do. They can use open source tools for load balancing. They can use the AWS load balancer. We generally see people using Kubernetes now, and Kubernetes also has its load balancers inside of it as well. So that's kind of the first decision. Then there's also, do you want to even be running it yourself? And this is where we have this product, Cockroach Cloud, which is we want to run the database for you. Running anything in the cloud, running any system is challenging. And we want to take that burden off developers and take it upon ourselves. Frankly, we're the experts in CockroachDB. We should be able to run it better than you. We should be able to run it more efficiently. We should be able to anticipate problems, make sure everything's set up correctly. So when we're running CockroachDB for you and on Cockroach Cloud, we support currently AWS and GCP. And we're running these CockroachDB clusters on top of Kubernetes. And what we've decided to do, though, is to use the native bits that are part of the cloud infrastructure. If you're on GCP and you want virtual private cloud peering, we're using you have to go through the Google APIs to use their VPC peering implementation. And similarly for AWS, we're using the AWS load balancers, the Google load balancers, and whatnot. This just gives the best experience on those platforms, though it does add more burden, but that's a burden we feel we should be taking on. I'm going to see how this plays out, though. We haven't added support for Azure. It's on our roadmap, but we're going to have to do kind of custom work in order to support Azure, rather than just dumping in something that worked exactly the same bits of code on every cloud. It really would be nice at some point if everybody, the entire tech ecosystem, could agree on cloud APIs and just make them symmetric across all the cloud providers, but we're certainly not in that world.
What do you think is the market size for distributed consistent SQL databases?
Oh, I really hope it's huge. So, I'm not sure what the market size at say right now is for kind of traditional SQL databases, but it's in the 30, 40, 50 billion range. I expect that, something like CockroachDB, we don't see it as taking up a niche spot in there. We see it taking up a significant spot. Anything you've traditionally used, a normal, kind of single node SQL database for, you can use CockroachDB in that same mode. So CockroachDB runs perfectly fine on a single node. The advantage is, I want high availability. Add a couple more nodes to the cluster and you get it kind of, just easy. There's no headache there. So our expectation is, we want to capture up and down that end of the, that entire spectrum of the market, not just occupying purely high-end clusters that have hundreds of nodes. No, we see this. We have many, many customers, 5, 10, 20 node clusters, perfectly happy there, with the expectation as their systems grow, they'll just continue to expand their clusters.
So the idea is really to be a pure successor to MySQL or Postgres as SQL infrastructure that scales more reliably or more readily.
Yeah, absolutely. And, we're also looking at scaling down the other way. There's a certain minimum node size you have for a MySQL instance. Let's get lower than that. Let's get smaller than that.
Can you tell me more about that? How can you shrink the typical size of a SQL deployment?
Well, it's not that so much you shrink the size of it, but just consider right now, you undoubtedly use Gmail for email. If you don't, you're from another planet as far as I'm concerned, but you're using some kind of hosted email service. You don't have a dedicated machine in a data center running your email. Your email is being shared inside, a much larger system. There's probably somewhere inside Google, there's a cluster with thousands of machines and you're occupying a fraction of, some subset of those machines. But the experience is you have your email. It's like an email database just for you. I mean, we can do the same thing with a cockroach cluster of subdivide even a cockroach cluster, give 1,000 users a perception that they're getting their own kind of custom cluster, even though it's being represented and implemented on the back end across, on top of a single much larger cluster. So, it's kind of giving that perception versus reality. Another example of this is just the virtualization of hardware. You go in and you start a VM up in Amazon, you're not getting a dedicated machine, you're getting a fraction of a machine. And it's all kind of, smoke and mirrors isn't quite the right phrase, but it's all technology in the back end to take a physical machine that might have 96 cores and give you one CPU of that or a fraction of a CPU even.
Give me a lesson in engineering management that you've learned since starting Cockroach 5 years ago.
That's a great question. The thing that, frequently comes to mind is communication. You just have to communicate and over-communicate and say the same thing again and not be surprised when there's some population, some subset of your engineering population that didn't hear something or is confused by something. It's just bound to happen. I think, prior to CockroachDB, I'd worked on smaller teams and led smaller teams, and it felt like easy enough to get everybody on the same page. Just as you scale and you grow, you just have to, just get that Zen attitude that, I answered that question last week, I'm going to answer it again this week, and just give them the same pitch and say it again and again. That communication is just critically important.
How do you think the current economic downturn will affect infrastructure companies like Cockroach?
Yeah. I go back and forth on this. I mean, clearly this downturn is, once in 100 years kind of thing. It's not like previous crises, financial crises. We can't really be looking for economic stimulus. We're looking for disaster recovery. I heard something, an analogy that's like everywhere in the world is getting hit by a hurricane for, 3 months straight. There are companies out there still spending. There are companies out there still making, spending money and buying infrastructure. And there's others that have just completely turned off the tap. We need to be focusing on those companies that are still spending. And, clearly, Amazon is still delivering. Various other, banks are still operating. The government's still operating. There are people buying stuff still. I think, we're going to come out of this. The economy overall is going to come out of this. The infrastructure spending is still going to continue. The near-term impact is just, ask me on 3 different days, I might give you 3 different answers.
That's not very consistent.
Yeah, it's not consistent, but we build a consistent database. I don't have to be consistent internally.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Just one last topic I wanted to talk about. So we do a lot of shows on databases. We also do a lot of shows on data infrastructure. And the funny thing about like data engineering infrastructure, like if you're talking about really large data workloads, like, Spark workloads or nightly batch Hadoop jobs, the thing with these, or machine learning, training machine learning models, the thing about these is the data infrastructure there is less consistent if we're talking about, things like the quote-unquote Lambda architecture or the fact that you have, data being read from these large data lakes or from some data warehouse where a large portion of data has been pulled into a data warehouse from a data lake. And this data may be slightly out of date. And the way that we build infrastructure today, the fact that the data is slightly out of date is not really a problem because usually we're finding aggregations or finding averages. We're just kind of averaging and mashing this data all together. I wonder is there a desire or is there a time in the future when we are going to need highly consistent OLAP data infrastructure as well?
I'm not sure if it'll need to be highly consistent, but I think having faster data pipelines is something interesting. And, we have a friend company, sibling company, maybe, which is called materialize.io. And they're working on, just really fast kind of materialized views for data, data pipelines. I think there are definite, use cases, strong use cases for that. And yet there's also, you know, other use cases. I'm sorry to, you know, be down on you guys materialize, but there's other use cases where the, you know, the latency concerns are not a problem. And we see this, you know, like the end of day reconciliation reports and whatnot. You know, it's like if you missed your transactions at midnight and then you can start it up and, you know, start your reconciliation process. And it's like, yeah, you know, like things will get reconciled the next day too. And somehow that, you know, perfectly up to date, that those super fast latencies are less important. So yeah, I see a world for faster, more consistent analytics. I think that's going to be slightly more niche.
Agreed. Yeah, we had the Materialize team on several weeks ago. So I guess they're in New York also.
That's correct. Yep. Hard to tell exactly where they are nowadays. We're all just isolated in our rooms, right?
Right. I completely agree. I think we are slowly sliding into virtual reality. It doesn't really feel as we anticipated. We're not looking at rendered avatars of each other, but it does feel like we're in a kind of virtual reality.
Yeah, you know, I had a kind of a similar thought the other day of what it would be like if there's instantaneous transportation, or transportation was no longer part of your life. And we're essentially, we don't have the instantaneous transportation, but transportation is certainly no longer part of most people's lives. And that's kind of like this thing that, you know, it feels a little bit like the future right now.
Yes. Yes. It's a little unnerving. I think that is part of what makes this whole virus experience so unnerving, is just the changes in our daily habits or lack thereof. Anyway, Peter, thank you for coming on the show. It's been really fun talking to you.
Yeah, pleasure being here.